folks. I'm really happy to have Dr. Soma Sengupta on today's podcast, the Keras Molecular Minute podcast. Soma, welcome to the show. Welcome to the Keras Molecular Minute podcast. I appreciate you taking time of your schedule to chat with me a little bit about a topic that has always confused the heck out of me, this neuro-oncology stuff. But before we get started, maybe a little bit about you as who you are, what you do, how do you spend your day in terms of various activities, and we'll get started.
So I'm a neuro-oncologist, as you rightly said, Chadi, and I'm very honored to be here today at the show. And regarding the podcast, as a neuro-oncologist, I take care of brain tumor patients, predominantly glioblastoma patients, recurrent glioma patients, but I also see the unusual pediatric tumors in adults, for example, medulloblastoma, ATRT, and I take care of patients with neurogenetic syndromes like neurofibromatosis, tuberous sclerosis. I also help with patients with brain metastasis and so forth. In terms of my background, I trained originally in the United Kingdom. So I did my physician's degree in MD and PhD at the University of Cambridge. And I practiced in England for a period of time, going through the training, the Royal College exams, all of that, and moved to the US with my spouse. And did my residency in the Boston system at Beth Israel Deaconess and Boston Children's Hospital. And I did my fellowship in neuro-oncology at Mass General Dana-Farber Brigham. My first job was as an attending in neuro-oncology at Beth Israel Deaconess. And then I moved to Emory for 3 years. And more recently, I'm at the University of Cincinnati as the director of neuro-oncology, Associate Professor of Neurology, and also Associate Director of the Brain Tumor Center. So that's me in a nutshell.
Amazing. You carry a lot of hats. Soma, do you have also a laboratory that you do work in the lab, or are you mainly just doing clinical work?
So I do a combination of things. So I do see patients. I run clinical trials. And I run a translational laboratory with my partner and spouse in sort of brain tumor research. And we look at neurotransmitter receptors in cancer, and we're about to submit a major paper on lung cancer brain metastasis. We work in the glioblastoma space, and I have worked in the medulloblastoma space in my laboratory. I have a fantastic team in Cincinnati, and so we do that, and we also have various sort of funding sources for the lab. In addition to the lab side of things and the clinical trials portfolio, I like investigator-initiated clinical trials. So I work with various researchers to try and bring cutting-edge trials into the neuro-oncology space. For example, I collaborate with Pankaj Desai at the University of Cincinnati, who's the head of pharmacy here. We're trying to design a phase two trial, you know, based on his research, and then working with Maria Castro and Pedro Lowenstein, developing an oncolytic virus trial with them. So IITs are something I really like doing too. In addition, I've done a fellowship while I've been doing all of this in integrative medicine at the Andrew Weil, and I'm just about to finish my MBA.
Oh boy. Do you sleep?
I try to, but you know how it is with kids in the house and then a house. Oh.
Soma, what's the current, you know, from a landscape perspective, for when somebody is a neuro-oncologist, are they trained with neurology and then they have a fellowship in neuro-oncology? Are they trained in medical oncology and then they subspecialize in neuro-oncology? So when you look at neuro-oncologists across the country, are they neurologists by training? Are they medical oncologists by training?
I think the majority of people in the United States, I would say, come from a neurology background, but there are some exceptional neuro-oncologists who have a medical oncology background too. So it's not exclusive of a neurologist going in. It can be either.
So I want to talk to you about GBM mainly. I mean, that's really the focus on today's call or podcast, the glioblastoma multiforme. Take me maybe through the way I'm going to devise our podcast is, one, any challenges in the diagnosis or anything new in terms of the molecular features of GBM. Second portion will be, how are you approaching this in the frontline setting? I mean, anything new there? And anything new in relapse disease that maintains hope for patients in terms of novel therapies? Because, it's as we all know, and my listeners know, it's never an easy disease to treat. The prognosis is never good. So I'm hoping that we leave this podcast with some glimpse of hope for listeners who have an interest in glioblastoma multiforme. So let's start with the diagnosis. Anything new there? This is a completely histologic diagnosis. Is it difficult to do? The grade, things like, what are the challenges in terms of diagnosis?
So in terms of diagnosis, there's an evolution. The WHO guidelines, the latest guidelines, have further differentiated the glioblastomas. You know, if you think of the IDH1 mutant or isocyclic dehydrogenase mutant high-grade gliomas, they're now called the high-grade gliomas, WHO grade 4, but they're not part of the GBM per se. Okay, so that's one area, and that's more. So
grade 4 are not part of the GBM?
So the IDH1 mutant ones are not a GBM because they behave differently. And I'll circle back to that in a minute. Going back to molecular targets and therapies, as you know, in the world of cancer, there are a ton of drugs that are used to target, but how do they get into the brain? So that's a major challenge. And I think one of the exciting innovations is focused ultrasound technology, using microbubbles where the blood-brain barrier can be opened up for 24 hours or more, allowing these therapies to get in. So that's an area I think that is of enormous interest, because then you can start using different kinds of agents to see if you can get them in to help treat the glioblastomas. And there are currently clinical trials in the space. Then other things to look at is, how do we analyze whether certain drugs work in glioblastoma? And traditionally, we've used mouse models, PDXs, transgenic models. But how about glioblastoma, other type of modeling? So there are organoid technologies now, and I'm working with Ricardo Baril at the University of Cincinnati, who is in bioengineering, and we're looking at creating a 3D GBM on chip, where we can have it recapitulate the animal models and look to see whether therapies are working or not. So I think that there are lots of technological advances that could help ameliorate the therapies.
You mentioned that with the diagnosis, the IDH1 mutants are not considered GBM because they behave differently, and we'll get anything else in terms of the diagnosis that is different. And when you say IDH1, I presume that then these patients need to undergo sequencing to detect IDH1 or not.
Yes. So traditionally, what we do at the institution I work in currently is all glioblastoma patients, their tissue undergoes Caris sequencing. So we know what the molecular profile is before we even start.
But the histologic diagnosis, is it less important now? Like, let's say if I send the specimen to 10 pathologists, is there universal agreement usually? Is there a little bit of difficulty in making the diagnosis?
With IDH, there usually isn't an issue.
How about the non-IDH ones?
Because they would be then the GBMs.
Got it. Okay. Now I'm in.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now you have a patient, first diagnosis, they just underwent either a complete resection, if that's possible, or they underwent you know, debulking or as much resection as you possibly can. And then they come to see you. How do you approach that patient in the first line setting?
So it depends on how they're doing clinically and the age group that the patient falls in. And age, I don't mean as a biological age. I mean as a health age. Okay. So if somebody is fit, able to travel, wanting something a bit outside of the box, then I often refer them to appropriate clinical trials, whether I have them in my institution or whether they are available in other institutions. If they are not candidates for that, then standard of care, which is based on the Stupp protocol, which has been used for a long time.
You want to tell us about that protocol? Like what happens? What do you do there?
Well, basically, you have the resection, and nowadays people are using 5-ALA to take out as much tumor as possible safely. Then you have the window of time where they recover post-op, and then they have, let's say it's a month hypothetically that they recover, and then 6 weeks of chemotherapy and radiation. So radiation Monday through Friday. And then the chemotherapy agent used is temozolomide as an alkylator, but at a low dose where it acts as a radiosensitizer. And then you have a month break after the radiation, get imaging again, and then you have cycles every month for 6 to 12 months, depending on where you're based, of the temozolomide at the higher dose. And you have imaging every 2 to 3 months to see whether your tumor is stable or whether you're progressing. If the tumor is progressing, then patient can go for a re-resection and possibly for another clinical trial.
Is there a chance of a complete cure with this approach? Are we just prolonging survival?
In terms of the standard of care, I would say prolonging survival. Patients who do best with it tend to be MGMT methylated glioblastoma.
So tell us about this a little bit, DM.
Yeah, and then the other thing I do need to add, with the standard of care, the Novocure's Optune device is also worn during the adjuvant cycle.
So tell us about that device and tell us about the MGMT.
So methylguanine methyltransferase, if you're methylated, that means that you don't break down the temozolomide as fast, and so your tumor becomes more sensitive to the drug. And so that, if you're methylated, it's actually a good thing because the drug is more active, the alkylator is more active. The Optune device is basically electric field that's worn in the form of arrays around the skull, and the head is shaven so that the contact can occur. And the device weighs about 2 pounds, and you have this electric current, and it's thought to inhibit rapid cell division of the cancer cells. So that, in conjunction with the alkylating agent, has been shown in clinical trials to improve survival.
So if you do the Neptune device, you don't, the Optune device, right?
Yeah.
You don't do radiation?
No, you do. It's during the adjuvant phase.
Okay, so it gives...
After radiation.
It gives additional radiation?
No. So 6 weeks, the chemo radiation, 1 month off, and then with the adjuvant cycles of TMZ, you have the Optune device.
Okay, but what does the Optune device do when you're giving it?
So it's giving electric energy, if you like, and inhibiting cell division. There are multiple mechanisms, but, you know, they're still trying to investigate exactly how things are occurring.
Then you continue that during the adjuvant therapy completely?
Yes, okay. Exactly.
So you do the surgery, you do the chemo radiation, and you do the chemotherapy plus the device. What are the statistics in terms of survival at 2 years or 1 year? Like what are we talking about here?
You know, you're talking about, you know, with the Optune device, and if you're methylated, 2 years or more than that, okay? if you did nothing, it would be where it would be under that amount. But in terms of how the Optune device is working and Novocure, there's actually a big clinical trial on at the moment called Trident, and it's a phase 3 clinical trial. And there, the Optune device patients are randomized to wear the Optune device also during radiation. So multiple centers are involved with that. So Chadi, you asked about whether it's worn during radiation. In this trial, it is.
It goes without saying that these are not great numbers.
No.
And obviously, you're very passionate about making a difference. So let's talk about relapse disease. What are the new therapies that are providing you with some hope for patients with this disease? And then number two is, it goes without saying that the best chance of cure is in the upfront situation. So what type of trials getting you excited in the upfront setting? So let's talk about relapse disease first. What do you do when patients relapse or they don't achieve a complete remission? You know, what are you going to do there? Because I hear about Avastin all the time and things like that. I just don't know, honestly, how good it works. So I'm very curious to see what is exciting you about with GBM.
In terms of Avastin, it doesn't improve survival. So what I tend to go for is, depending on the clinical status of the patient, if there are vaccine trials available in the recurrent setting, I will refer them for those. In addition, I mentioned the focused ultrasound technology. There are clinical trials using that technology with various agents. And then the third thing I'm interested in is if a patient has interesting molecular mutations, and we know that the drug crosses the blood-brain barrier, then we use that agent off-label on a single patient IND basis. That requires a lot of work, and I'm fortunate where I work currently. We have an excellent pharmacy and clinical trials office where they really do help make that happen. So even if a patient can't go for a clinical trial with that targeted drug, we often can put them on the targeted drug. So that's where Caris sequencing comes in very useful.
You mentioned the IDH1 earlier. So for IDH1, are you adding an IDH1 inhibitor to the Temodar and to the radiation?
No, but I have used IDH1 inhibitors for those patients further down the road.
So what are you guys doing in the neuro-oncology world about frontline setting? I say that, Soma, because I think we are in dire need for progress in this field. I mean, honestly, for 10 years, it's been Temodar and radiation. I mean, I would love to see something more.
Yeah. So currently, University of Cincinnati has brought in what's called the IMPACT trial. That was led by David Andrews and his team. And that is using an antisense oligo to IgB1. And so the patient's own system, so you take the tumor and you reimplant into the peritoneum so that the patient's own immune system works against this. And then this antisense is created for the patient, if you like. And this vaccine is being sort of made now by the Invax makers, and this trial has been started. I agree with you. I think more novel technologies like this need to be done so that there are more interesting ways of trying to treat glioblastoma patients. So that's an example of this. I think that more immune trials would be interesting, but thinking not just copying what's done in the melanoma realm, but really understanding the immunobiology in gliomas and designing things more appropriately for the glioma space would be a good way to go.
Is there any immuno-oncology therapy that is showing promise in patients with GBM?
There are a bunch of things that are being tried right now, and I think UNC has a phase 1 trial that's ongoing with a CAR-T design, and there are some other sites in the country also looking at specific CAR-Ts. that seem to be promising. But I think that thinking beyond the CAR T space, I think there are, I would probably favor a more vaccine mediated approach.
How about Avastin and angiogenesis, anti-angiogenesis therapies?
So Avastin on its own in sort of clinical trials or the standard agents hasn't really been shown to do that much. There's been some reports of it, of benefits with irinotecan. Along with the Paris working group, I've been working with FGFR3, TEC3 fusion. And it looks that certain drugs with, in that setting, with anti-angiogenesis agents may hold promise. And that's work that I'm doing with Richard Liu at Cincinnati Children's in a transgenic mouse model and the Caris working group as well.
So is the future bright for this disease? I mean, tell me, I mean, you're living this and breathing this every day. Give us some hope, ray of hope.
Yeah. So I wouldn't say the word is bright, but I would say there's cautious optimism. As we understand the pathology of the disease better and we can delineate the pathology, we can create IDH1 mutant vaccine. Vaccines are being made and more targeted therapies that work are happening. So I think that there are rays of light that are coming on the horizon. And I think, you know, as more translational approaches are thought about and ways to really fuel the immune side of things in a manner that works in the brain, that will probably change things and cause a paradigm shift in the illness. Whether it'll happen in the next few years, I'm not sure, but I think it'll eventually.
Well, Soma, this has been wonderful. I think we got like a quick crash course in how we deal with GBMs, and I appreciate you taking the time with the Caris Molecular Minute podcast. I hope the next time we have you on the show, we have more new treatments and more advances in a very difficult to treat disease.
Well, I really appreciate the time and collaboration that I have with Caris, and thank you for the invitation.
Dr. Soma Sengupta on the Caris Molecular Minute podcast. Thank you.